Chapter 19 of Green Grey Homestead by Steele Rudd. This Legomus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Read by Anna Simon. Though it will take you a couple of years to establish a footing at old Silas King's place, and win his consent to your courting Josie, you'll get her all the same, and have a great wedding, too, the greatest ever known in the district, and at old Silas's expense, and in his house. It will seem as if everything is being taken out of your hands at first, and that you are no one, especially when he invites nearly all the guests, selecting only those who are friends of his. But you'll soon realize that his arrangements will save you a lot of work, as well as worry and expense, which will make up for a lot. Besides, you'll be able to give more time to her during the wedding eve, and everything will go off pleasantly for both of you on the day. Then you'll go off yourselves, go off full of joy and sunshine and plans for the future, after the wedding breakfast, and the kissing and handshaking, to spend your honeymoon. You'll spend it at home, at your little grey homestead. It will be quieter there, and you'll be left more to yourselves than you would be at a strange place. But you won't decide to spend it there merely because it possesses those virtues and advantages, but more because, having put your heads together a score of times, months before, and thought everything out carefully, you both concluded that unless Papa comes good with 100 or 200 in cash as a wedding present for all she's done for him in the home and in the dairy, helping to make him independent, you won't be able to afford a trip anywhere, as you'll want all the money you've scraped together and saved to pay for the furniture and additions to the house. And though old Silas has got over all the objections he had to you personally, and holds the wedding at his house for you, and tells the guests with tears in his voice when replying to the toast of the bride's parent that he's sure she's selected the right man for her husband. A good, industrious, God-fearing, dinkum young Aussie. And though he's proud to have you for a son-in-law, you won't see his check among the presents displayed on the table. In the excitement of becoming a father-in-law, he'll forget all about it. But you'll feel nothing but good towards him, for you'll know he doesn't mean anything by it, that it's only a part of his nature. Lots of well-to-do men and fathers of families in these advanced years are absent-minded about money and presents. When at last you're stealing away on the quiet from the festival with your bride in her travelling dress on your arm, and all the old women gathering round her to say the last good-bye, and whispering hints in her ear, old Silas will be engaging some of the favourite guests in the parlour, where no flirting and dancing are going on, and he'll be hanging his pious lip, and shaking his head, and sighing like a martyr, as he tells them that you ought to be able to afford to take her for a trip to the Blue Mountains, or somewhere, for your honeymoon, if you were any sort of a cove at all, especially after all the help he's been giving you. But as you'll be rolling along the lanes in the sulky, while he's saying it, with your arm round Josie, and smiling under her head at her, whenever you risk taking your eyes off the horse, you, of course, won't hear him, and you will not be perturbed by the impression he's giving them of you, and the splendid light he's putting himself in as a benefactor and helpful parent. So you'll spend your honeymoon in your own way, and enjoy it perhaps as much as a prince or a millionaire would. And the little home you'll take Josie to will be as comfortable as most of the homes that young couples begin married life in the bush. Besides, being on the spot in half an hour or so, the time you would otherwise have wasted travelling long distances by rail or boat, and strolling about seashores and streets and parks, you can devote to building a wash-house or something for Josie, or making her a vegetable garden, and you'll be able to undo a lot of little things you did on your own account months before, and do them all over again under her direction and to her liking, and so have the place looking just as she wants it to look when her young friends come along to pay their first visits. And a bride's young friends are always full of eyes and enthusiasm for the place she's living in when first they visited, especially the female section of them. It relieves their depression and gives them hope of the future. The first to call, though, will be old Silas himself. One afternoon he'll arrive leisurely in his sulky, gazing cynically about at everything on your little homestead as he approaches. Of course, you won't be expecting him, and when Josie excitedly announces that, "Papa is coming, Dick! Here's Papa!" and runs out to meet him, you'll get in a funk and start scraping dough from your hands so that he won't see you've been filling in the honeymoon by showing Josie how you used to make dampers for yourself when you were batching.
"Well, please God, I'm glad to see you, my girl. And how are you getting along in your new home?"
Papa will greet her.
"The Lord in his goodness is watching over the two of you, I hope."
Then, as he enters the door,
"Dick, I suppose, is out and hard at work again."
Josie, blushing and smiling proudly on your behalf, will answer that you'll be there in a minute, that neither of you have done anything yet. "Except to milk the cows in the morning, and it wouldn't do not to milk them."
"No, no, of course," Silas will agree, taking stock of the bit of furniture you've started the home with as he settles himself on the new sofa. "They'd soon be all ruined if you didn't."
Meanwhile, you've freed the infernal dough from your fingers, straightened your shirt-sleeves, and, combing your hair with your hand, you'll come from the kitchen and welcome your father-in-law in a stammering, uncertain voice, with a face beaming with fabricated grins. Though it's your honeymoon, you can't help feeling ashamed of being discovered inside the house, idling the happy hours away, and at an hour, too, when you know everyone else in the district is out in the fields working for their lives. And you can't converse freely and get as near to your father-in-law as you would like to when all the time you are doubtful how to address him, whether you should call him Papa, the same as Josie does, or stick to Mr. King. Several times it will be on the tip of your tongue to call him Papa, but never being brought up to calling your old man by such a polished highfalutin appellation, the attempt will stick in your throat and nearly choke you. But after a while you'll begin to feel more like a relation, and when at last he asks in an interested way,
"Are you going to plant any barley this year, Dick, or put all your ground under wheat?"
you'll unthinkingly come out with, "Oh, I think I'll put it all under wheat, Papa."
And soon as you hear what you've said, you'll turn crimson and grin like a criminal. And when you see Josie trying to keep from laughing, and old Silas himself staring and biting at his underlip as if it was your tongue he had between his teeth, you'll feel sorry you spoke, and inwardly determined to see him dead before you'll make such an ass of yourself again. Still, you'll forget all about it in a minute or two, and you'll get on so well together that you'll be showing him everything you've done to make the little home comfortable for Josie, and detailing the improvements you've made to the farm, and all that you intend making, to all of which old Silas will nod approval and appreciation. And when Josie in her turn shows him the wide-end veranda that you added to the house for her, and explains in raptures that all she wants now to complete her joy is a small room on the end of it so she can accommodate an extra visitor any time there might be a rush, or, "Where you could sleep yourself, Papa," she'll enthuse, "whenever you decide to come and stay for a week with us," you'll start wondering, with a fast-beating heart, if old Silas will open his purse and build the room for you. Just for the moment, a beneficent look on his face will give you the impression that he might. But it will only be for a moment. Instead of opening his purse, he'll open your eyes. "There's a room on the veranda of that little old deserted place on the reserve, Dick," he'll suggest, turning to you. "It would just suit this veranda, if no white ants have got into it."
"Where all the goats camp?" he'll grin in disparagement, and casting a glance of disappointment at Josie.
"But you won't want the goats," he'll bark at you, "and if the timber is still sound you ought to be able to get it as a bargain from the council, and it wouldn't take you more than a day to pull it down and cart it away while the weather is fine."
You look at him as if he was your enemy, and for a while you can't decide what answer to make. But, reading your face like a barometer, Josie will change the subject.
"And there's one other thing, though, that Dick has got to get yet for me, Papa," she'll say, with a cheerfulness that only a woman can be capable of perpetrating.
"Well, if there's only one, "You haven't got a very long list of wants for him to satisfy, my girl," her parent will interrupt. "You're not like your poor mother was, God rest her in her narrow bed, when she got married."
And for a moment or two he'll close his eyes in pious reflection. "And that's a good sulky horse," Josie will conclude. "One I can have to drive whenever I go out, without worrying Dick for one that he's working."
"Yes," old Silas will concur, regarding her thoughtfully with his hollow eyes, and once again you'll get a notion that he means to do something big and generous. You'll know that his grass paddocks are overrun with horses of all descriptions, and your keen mind will run on the familiar forms of several young colts, any one of which would make an ideal sulky horse for a woman.
"A good sulky horse, my girl," he'll echo in reflection,
"and you'll reckon your father-in-law is going to come good this time for sure. Perhaps make a present of two of those horses, one to each of you."
In fact, before you can speak the word, you'll be quietly reckoning that to save questions being raised in the future, it would be wise to get him to write out a receipt for them right on the spot. Also, you'll be wondering whether it would be wiser to put your registered brand on them both, or wait till Josie applies for a brand of her own to put on hers. But when at last old Silas opens his mouth to speak, he'll turn to you again and remark,
"Well, horses are very cheap just now, Dick, and you oughtn't to have any trouble getting what you want at the sale yards on almost any Saturday."
Oh, mighty! A sinking feeling will come over you again, but you'll feebly agree with him. Then, recovering, you'll reckon the first thing you're going to do when you get back into harness is run into the sale yards with a few quid in your pocket and see how horses are going. You'll be inclined to let the matter end there, but your father-in-law was always fond of talking about horses, and will wonder that you haven't got a few spare ones running on your farm.
"For you never know when you want them,"
he'll add, as lightly as though acquiring horse-flesh is as easy to you with limited means as gathering firewood. But when you start coughing instead of answering him, he'll gaze through the window at your yards and cowsheds and ask,
"How many cows are you milking?"
But here Josie, like the splendid helpmate she promises to be, will come to your rescue again with,
"Dick's been milking 10 up to now, Papa, but with me to help him, from this on he'll be milking 20.
"Eh," old Silas will grunt, "that's not much of a change to get married for, girl. You could get plenty of milking at home when you were single."
"But we'll be milking for ourselves now, Papa,"
Josie will laugh, while you'll add a few confirmatory nods and grins.
"Yes, yes, quite so, quite so," from old Silas.
Then, remembering his time is short, that he only snatched an hour to drive over to see how you were both getting along, and further expressing his gladness at finding you both so well and happy, and in want of nothing, he'll take his departure. But before stepping into the sulky, he'll consign Josie again to your care, telling you that
she's in your hands now, and take care of her, take care of her.
Then, standing together, watching him rolling away down the road, you'll turn to Josie, and drawing her to you in the altitude of emotion, your cheek to hers, you'll croon in her ear, "And I am taking care of you, Josie, ain't I?" The honeymoon will be fading out now, and you'll be back in harness again. But you're beginning to find you're a different man. Life has become more serious to you. You're an independent person, in your own eyes, and in the eyes of Josie's friends who come to see her. You'll realize how quickly a young wife can raise her husband in the esteem of others, and how he can convince himself that it's all due to his own merits. So the months go by. You've reaped a good harvest and waved your first sheaf. You're finding it's almost as cheap for two to live as it is for one. Yet, as much as you love each other and pull evenly together, the same constant self-contained unvarying society somehow palls. There's something lacking. You don't quite understand what it is. Not being an artist or alleged painter of realism, your mind won't dwell on creative effort or the imitating of nature as a solution. Still, you'll be making the most you can of everything
and doing your best to make life pleasant and prosperous and easy for Josie. She'll be doing her best, too, to help and uplift you, cooking, making, mending, saving and comforting. And she'll become engaged in sewing and cutting out a new sort of clothes and things from patterns lent her by Mrs. Edie and Mrs. Boody on the next homesteads. This will seem to be special work she has undertaken, which you won't be informed about, until one day she'll startle you by complaining of not being well, and telling you to go at once for her friend, Mrs. Brown. Cripes, you'll nearly be taken ill, too. You'll turn pale. Then you'll think of the horse and sulky. You haven't a car yet, and half bewildered you'll run for the Winkers. All the poetry will go out of married life for you as you leave Josie alone and rush up the paddock to catch snip. As bad luck will have it, there's not an animal within call of the yard. They are all up on the ridge. And just when you locate snip, after running, blundering and puffing till you're fit to drop, it will suddenly dawn on you that he won't let anyone but Josie herself catch him in the paddock. Holy! What are you going to do? And being one of the cutting ones, he won't submit to being yarded on foot. So you'll approach him downheartedly, coaxing, grovelling, crawling to him. But all your efforts will be useless, for he'll calmly look at you, and, cocking his tail in disrespect, will trot off out of reach. An idea will come to you. You'll run back to the house to put on a dress and hat of Josie's and return to Snip. You've put them on and have come out of the house again, when, salvation, the voice of your father-in-law greets you. You'll stop, surprised. So will he. "What in God's name, man, are you dressed up like that for?" he'll ask. "Are you demented?" But when you gasp out everything to him, he'll become more alarmed and concerned than you. "For God's sake, here, man," he will choke, alighting to the ground. "Get into my sulky and go for your life. Go for your life. You had a right to have your own horse harnessed and ready every night and every day." Next minute you'll be flogging your way along the wide lane at breakneck pace to Mrs. Brown's place, while old Silas will hobble back home on foot, grunting and mumbling grievously at every turn. 'Twas no place for a man to find himself at such a time, at such a time. Young fools, they will get married, will get married. End of chapter 19.